From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, the wonderful Dan Schwartz, dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Hello, Dr. Big Data Pope.
It is
good to see you.
I would not call me Big Data Pope by any means, but it is good to see you, Dan.
So today, spectacular show. We're talking with Sean Reardon, who's kind of changing what we know about poverty in schools. Sean's done some amazing things with data. And so he has, maybe it's big data. And so my question to you, Dr. Pope, is like, how big does big have to be before we say something's big data?
I don't know is the answer. I mean, I'm a qualitative researcher, so I tend to do very, very small data. Like, I followed 5 kids for a year, and that was a lot of work, right?
So rich data.
Rich data.
Rich data, not big data.
Not big. I mean, we have one of our data sets right now for Challenge Success has 100,000 students, and that feels really, really big to me. But I know that's nothing compared to what you think of as big data.
Yeah, right? So Professor Reardon has 300 million test scores. And it's big in the sense that it's everybody's data. But here's even bigger.
Wait, what does that mean? It's everybody's data.
It's the test score of just about every child in the U.S.
Okay, that's big.
Yeah, so it's big in the sense that it is the population. Here's a different version of big data. There's a company that has handheld instruction on the cell phone. And you're learning English, and you're reading the text, and the company collects all the audio files of 55 million people using this thing for, say, 100 hours. So that's big data. With something like that, you no longer have to look at the average. You can look at 100,000 different pathways through the content.
I can't even begin to think about that. That just blows my mind.
Is it bigger than one thumb drive? Maybe that's the definition of big data.
To me, like a thumb drive is kind of little because it's just that little thing that's, you know, it's like an inch long. But what's on there, yeah, I have no, my brain has no way of even thinking about this.
Yeah, so the availability of data is really changing the social sciences. You know, you used to have a very, very strong hypothesis and then you would test it against a sample. But now we have data that's so big that we use the data to actually help us figure out what the hypotheses should be. And so it's really shifted everything.
Do you think that that makes our research better, more accurate? What does that do?
I think it changes the nature of the claims. So it used to be, so I've heard people in this space like that are making autonomous cars. You know, these cars are driving around 24 hours a day just collecting data. And there's lots and lots of these cars on the road that are collecting data so that the cars can learn to make decisions. The argument that they make is you don't need a theory anymore.
What does that mean, you don't need a theory?
You don't need a theory. You've got all the data. It just tells you exactly what you can make perfect predictions. You don't need a theory to help you handle the world of sparse data.
Our guest is kind of moving his head in a way that says he's not so sure he agrees. So maybe we should move to our guest.
So I'd like to introduce Sean Reardon. Sean Reardon has medium-sized big data.
Oh, okay.
He's the professor of poverty and inequality in education at Stanford. His research looks at how different economic and social conditions impact a child's education. He has some recent research that is in the press, in the New York Times, among other places, where he's looking at these test scores. And we're going to talk to Sean about that. So welcome.
Welcome, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
Before we start, I think people don't quite understand the challenge of getting the test score of every child organized in a way you can do something with this. Because all the data is there, so I don't know why this is difficult.
It turns out to be a lot harder than it should be. For the last 15 years, public schools in the United States have tested virtually every third through eighth grader every year in both math and reading, and that generates a huge number of test scores. The problem is every state gets to decide which test to use, so they're testing math using a different test. Every grade uses a different test. They change the test sometimes from one year to the next. So trying to figure out how you compare the scores of kids in Palo Alto, say, to kids in Chicago is not very easy.
But you came up with a very clever solution. You found a way, you sort of found the Archimedes point where you could connect all the different sources of data to one common metric that allowed you to solve this problem.
That's right. It's sort of like if you ask people how many hot days or how hot it is in their city, and some people said, oh, it's hot 12 days a year, and some people said it's 36 degrees Kelvin, and some people said it's 47 degrees Celsius. We essentially found a way of putting all of those things on the same scale so that you could say in Fahrenheit, you know, how hot it is, mm-hmm. is it in your city, and how Fahrenheit, how hot it is in my city. So we do that using a test called NAEP, which is a test given to representative samples of kids in every state in the country. And by using that, we can link the different states' tests together.
That's awesome. And then your data set has other things besides test scores.
Yeah, so we collect data from different sources like the Census and the National Center for Education Statistics on things like the median income in a community, the percent of people with a bachelor's degree, and so on. And we can use that to understand not just the test scores in a school district, but also the economic conditions there.
So tell us what you found.
So what we do is we take these test scores, 300 million test scores over the last 7 years from about 45 million kids, and we measure the average academic performance in math and reading in every school district in the United States. That's about 11,000 school districts. And we start by just comparing how well kids score on tests in different places. And as you might expect, there's a lot of variation. And rich places have a lot higher test scores than poor places. But what we were interested in is, do rich places tend to have higher test scores because kids are learning a lot more while they're in school? Or do they have higher test scores because their kids get to school early on already with lots of academic skills? And then they sort of maintain that advantage. So we looked at the growth rate of children's test scores from third to eighth grade in every school district in the country. And what we found is pretty surprising, actually. Places vary a lot in how much kids learn in middle school and elementary school, and that's not as related to socioeconomic conditions as you'd expect. Lots of poor districts have fast growth rates. Lots of affluent districts have not so great growth rates. And so knowing something about the average test scores and the economic conditions of place turns out not to tell us a whole lot about how much kids are learning while they're in school.
Can I just make sure people understand what you mean by growth rate? What do you mean by growth rate?
That's a good question. We look at children's scores in third grade, and then we look at that same cohort of kids 5 years later when they're in eighth grade. Well, we actually look at them every year, but think of it, we're sort of comparing kids' eighth grade scores to their third grade scores to see how much more they know in eighth grade than third grade. And in some districts, that's a lot more, and in some districts, it's not as much more.
And usually you say things like, in 4 years, they gain the equivalent of 5 years of right. educational content.
Right.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are speaking with Sean Reardon today about how he's using test scores to make predictions about what kids are learning in different cities and how well they're doing.
So I want to talk about this kind of a striking finding. You would think if there's a school district where all the kids come in low, then the school district probably has a heavier lift and won't bring them forward as much. But you didn't find that. Say more about this, because this is a kind of a stunning separation of incoming and gain.
It turns out that how much kids know when they, by the time they get to third grade, which is the earliest point we can see their test scores, isn't very related to how much they learn. That means some places kids come in with low scores and learn a lot. Some places kids come in with low scores and don't learn a lot. Some places they come in with high scores and learn a lot, and others they don't. So it turns out that knowing what the sort of average scores are in a place doesn't tell us a whole lot about whether kids have those high scores because of what they came in with or because of how much they're learning in third to eighth grade. And what's striking, I think, is the variation across places. So you were saying early on that what can we learn from big data? I think one of the things you can learn from big data is not just what the average trend is, but you can learn all the variation. So we've known for a long time that poor kids have fewer educational opportunities and get to school in kindergarten with lower academic skills. And on average, they don't catch up a whole lot by eighth grade or by high school. But what we didn't know was how much variation there is around that average. There are places like Chicago where kids in third grade have test scores that are a grade and a half below where they should be. And by eighth grade, they've almost caught up to the national average. And then there are other places with the opposite pattern. So this, the variation, I think, can teach us a lot.
If you are living in Chicago right now, you're pretty happy. But if you're living in some of those places where the growth isn't that high, so I'll give you a quick example. I actually put my kids' school district in this paper. There's a way that you could put your school district in and see where it pops out and see where that growth number is. And it wasn't the highest, and it definitely wasn't the lowest. And I didn't know, should I be happy about that? Should I be sad about that? Because I think of it as a good school district. It's kind of known as a good school district. And I was sort of surprised to see who was above us.
Well, I don't know if you should be happy or sad, but I would say that test scores and growth in test scores is certainly not the only thing we should use to measure the effectiveness or the quality of a school system. So if you're a parent, you probably care about how much your kids, you know, can read and do math. Those are useful things. But you also care about whether they're happy and they're creative and they make friends easily and they're good, cooperative, and a whole bunch of other skills that aren't necessarily measured by the kinds of math and reading tests we give kids. And so if you think about schools, what they're trying to do and what we want them to do, it's a lot more than math and reading skills. So we shouldn't say this is the sum total of how we should measure schools, but I still think it's a useful measure, because if kids are getting to eighth grade without the kinds of reading skills they're going to need to be successful in high school and go on to college and so on, then that's a real problem. That really limits their opportunities. And so think of these tests as maybe a kind of a necessary but not sufficient kind of measure of what school should be doing.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are speaking with Sean Reardon about a study he's done looking at test scores and student growth over time. You can actually measure where your school is with Sean's research.
So, yeah, tests, lots of evil, but then they can do lots of good, sort of like everything. And so you found a way to use them to really help us illuminate that school districts' policies and teaching practices make a difference. So I'm going to ask you a question. While I'm asking Sean that question, Denise, in your mind, you have to be predicting what his answer will be.
Okay, I will be predicting because I have ESP.
Okay. So I'm a parent, and I'm moving into a new place. And I just happen to be exactly on the line that splits two districts. One district, their eighth grade achievement scores are higher than the other district. So District A has higher achievement than District B. But District B has greater gain scores, so from third to eighth grade. Should I send my kid to District A, where on average they have higher eighth grade achievement, or should I send my child to District B, where the amount of gain from third to eighth grade is greater?
And how old is your child?
Third grade.
How convenient.
right? How convenient. Dan always takes the convenient path
on these. No, that's not why. It's because I always look at my child as a third grader.
He's never grown up.
He's 31. He's a third grader in my heart.
Yes. Oh, my goodness.
Sometimes my colleagues are third graders.
Yes.
If your child were in third grade, you should care a lot more about the growth rates from third to eighth grade, because whatever opportunities exist in the other community that got kids good skills by third grade, those are you're too late for that. Mm. You should go to the place with high growth.
Wow. Was that your prediction, Denise?
No, totally not. I really thought it was going to be School A, because I was thinking that it gets everybody to where they need to be at this really high point, but it's the average, right, to your point. So we don't know if my kid or Dan's kid will actually get there.
So I thought it was going to be, is your third grader low achieving or is your third grader high achieving?
Right.
If they're high achieving, put them in District A that looks better at eighth grade. If they're low achieving, put them in District B where they're going to gain more.
How do you know if your kid is high achieving or low achieving? This is for a parent? Everyone thinks their kid is.
You look them in the eye and you say 2 + 7.
Everyone's above average. We're also talking about averages here, so that's not to say you should judge where you're going to live solely on the basis of the average outcomes of kids there. But I think a lot of parents do that already because that's the only information they have. So if you go to greatschools.org or your state website or somewhere, and you look up where are the good schools, they're going to rank the schools by the average test scores of kids in that district in eighth grade or in third through eighth grade or something. And it may be that a place has good test scores not because the schools are particularly great. It may be because they have a lot of affluent families who can invest a lot in their kids. They have really good preschools and really good child care, and the neighborhoods are safe. And so it creates conditions where kids can thrive, but it might not be the schools that are doing it.
Interesting.
And so that's why I think it's useful to complement that kind of information with information about growth rates, because it tells you about a different dimension of what makes a place a potentially good place to raise your kid.
So just this is a little bit of a tangent. So have real estate companies gotten after your database so they can, like, do you get a cut of when they market certain homes because of the school district they're in?
No. We made all the data public because we think it's a public good. Your tax dollars, my tax dollars, they pay for kids to take these tests, and they're public information. And so we put the data out for public good, but we put them out with a non-commercial use license so that people can use them, but we don't think people should monetize them since they're a thing that was paid for with public money.
Very good.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We will have more with Sean Reardon and the implications of his study on growth using test scores as the measure from third to eighth grade. Next on SiriusXM Insight 121.
We translate the research we know about best practices with school, curriculum, and parenting to teachers, administrators, parents, and youth.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Sean Reardon, a professor here in the Graduate School of Education at Stanford, about a study just out where he looks at test scores, but also uses them to measure growth over time. Something pretty exciting to see that schools actually can have some movement when it comes to where kids start and where they end up. So, Sean, here's my question for you. Can schools get kids out of poverty? I mean, we've been hearing sort of a lot of poo-pooing around this, that, you know, where you're born makes a difference. And
poo-pooing.
Is that not a word? That's a phrase. There are doubters and naysayers out there. Dan Schwartz may even be one of them. Can a school get you out of poverty? Can it lift you up?
It can be part of the solution, I think. A lot of people would say poverty creates too many disadvantages for kids and it's too big of a lift for the school system to sort of create the kind of opportunity for upward mobility we would like. And I think that's maybe true in a sort of average sense. But one of the things that we can see in our data is that there are some school districts that are very poor where kids actually learn a lot during the school years, and the schools seem to play a role in creating educational opportunity and providing the conditions where they can do pretty well. That doesn't mean that every low-income school is doing that, and it doesn't mean that it's necessarily enough to overcome deep poverty. If you sort of take Chicago again as an example, Chicago is pretty poor by national standards. Students score about like other poor districts do there, about a grade and a half below third grade when they get to third grade. And Chicago kids learn at a faster rate than almost any other school district in the country, certainly than any other large district. But even there, they only get sort of close to average by eighth grade, not kind of all the way to average, and certainly don't get to the kind of level of achievement you see in the affluent and suburban districts. So are the schools sort of enough in Chicago, even though they seem to be really effective? No. But are they making a significant contribution? In some places, yeah.
So the school districts, the amount that students gain within a school district is not correlated with parental income, right? So is this true if we cut it up other ways? Say we cut it up by race or ethnicity, we find the same, that there's not a correlation between the gain and whether it's the school is predominantly serving one subpopulation versus another?
Somewhat. If you think of these sort of two dimensions, that is, one dimension is how well kids are doing by third grade, and the other dimension, how well how much they learn from third to eighth grade. You could think of sort of four types of school district. The sort of high ones where kids know a lot in third grade and learn a lot. The low ones where both were the opposite, and then the sort of high low high ones. And if you think of school districts as being in sort of one of those four types.
So just low high might be low incoming scores, high gain over 5 years.
Right. And high low would be
high incoming.
Yeah,
no, but you don't get.
You confused me.
You don't get so far.
Yeah. So there are about equal numbers of schools and districts in all those quadrants. If you look at the school districts where white students are, they're mostly on the two quadrants, the two types of schools that have high incoming scores. But many of them have low growth, many of them have high growth. If you look at the school districts where black or Hispanic students are concentrated, they tend to be low on incoming levels, but some are high on growth and some are low on growth. So the big distinction is really in the levels kids have of achievement early on. There's less distinction in terms of growth rates, some, but not as much. So that is to say, the big reason for the racial achievement gaps we see seems to be mostly due to low opportunities to gain those kinds of skills early in childhood and in the early elementary grades, not so much because of low growth rates when they're in school.
Mm-hmm. This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Sean Reardon about using test scores to really talk about the quality of what's going on inside the schools and how much the schools can do to lift kids out of poor situations.
So I find this very optimistic, and not in a bad way. That
wait, Dan. Optimistic is what's the bad way around optimistic? Optimistic is good, usually all the time.
Fine.
Thank you.
Fine.
Thank you.
This is optimistic, not in a bad way, in the sense that we're sort of dreaming of castles in the air.
Okay.
That it's optimism based in fact and reality. So there.
Gotcha.
Okay.
I'm with you.
So there, schools can make a difference, and well-run school districts seem to really sort of overcome the odds. So now, how about kindergarten or third grade? Is it one account is it's really the community, the social environment where for some reason these kids come in low. Another is no, it's actually the kindergarten through third grade where there wasn't much of a gain, or probably a combination of both. So are you going to collect a few hundred million more scores? Or
I would love to. The downside is that we'd have to do it ourselves right now. So
wait, does that mean you'd have to go out and test 100 million students?
Yeah, that
sounds a little difficult.
That's a lot of sheets of paper.
I don't think we would.
Especially
do that.
In kindergarten where they don't read. How are you going to do that one?
You got to do it sort of one-on-one with them. So. So the challenge is we only have data going back to as early as third grade. There are some other smaller studies that have only 20,000 kids in them, for example, that track kids from kindergarten all the way up through middle school. And when you look at those studies, the low-income students come to kindergarten with much lower school readiness skills than the high-income kids. And those gaps don't change much by third grade or by eighth grade. So that sort of says, on average, a lot of the action is early. But again, the average isn't mm-hmm. thing. There are probably lots of places where kids learn a whole lot from kindergarten through third grade in their schools, and others where they learn less.
So we actually had a question from a teacher who wrote to us on Facebook Live. And I think this is a good time to try to answer that teacher's question. The question is, what should a teacher do hearing this data? What should the teacher role be? If I am a teacher in one of those third to eighth grade districts that looks like it's Chicago, I'm feeling pretty good. If I am a K through third grade teacher just now hearing what you said, I'm thinking, wait a minute, do I not make a difference? I'm working so hard every day. So what's your kind of advice to teachers listening to and parsing this data?
Well, there's nothing in our study that says kindergarten through third graders teachers don't make a difference. That we can't see any of that in our data. So don't
because you don't have the
because
data.
We don't have the data.
Right.
But I think what should teachers do? I think maybe the broader question is sort of what should people in different communities do. So if you're the superintendent or the principal or a community leader or a parent. The question is sort of what's working well to provide educational opportunities for kids early on in their lives in this community, as well as in the elementary and middle school years and beyond. And so we've been talking to superintendents and folks at different school districts around the country to sort of who are really interested in saying, okay, if the problem is that we have a large achievement gap, when does that arise? What does our data say about when it arises? And if it arises really early, that suggests maybe we need to start thinking about community-based interventions and strategies to provide, you know, better child care opportunities, better preschools, more developmental opportunities early on in the community. If it grows a lot during the school years, then it says maybe we need to really think about what are we doing in the schools that can support that. And so I think my hope is the data isn't going to tell you what you should do in your community, but it's going to tell you sort of where you should look. What's sort of the right age and subgroups and so on to sort of target your strategies to make things better. And hopefully we can learn from places where they have high growth and figure out what's effective.
So is one of your hopes that the research community will start to say, okay, we've now seen the description. Someone needs to go in there and figure out what's going on so that we can come up with some causal story.
Yeah, I mean, think of this like epidemiology. Think of this as educational epidemiology. You go out and you map the patterns of health and well-being if you're an epidemiologist, or in our case, we map the patterns of educational success and educational opportunity. And that's sort of a necessary but not sufficient part of the figuring out what to do about it.
Great analogy. Yeah. I really like that. So if people want to learn more, or if they if they're like Denise and they want to find out about their school.
Yeah.
It's all about me.
It's all this time it is. No. Yeah.
So two things. One, the New York Times did a story this morning that has some interactive graphics with our data where you can find your school districts, and the other is our website, ceda.stanford.edu.
Thank you. Thanks for being here, Sean, and thank you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're on the campus of Stanford University and on Sirius XM Insight 121.